Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Piotr Savinsky, director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum on the occasion of the 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz today. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's customary at the inauguration of a new president for us here at Too Jewish Radio to focus on the Jewish aspects of the new administration. And we could certainly be forgiven for doing so with the new Biden administration, which has a Jewish vice presidential husband for the first time in history. Actually, he's the first vice presidential husband in history altogether, Doug Emhoff. And an unprecedented number of Jewish cabinet members, including Biden's chief of staff, secretary of state, secretary of the treasury, and attorney general. When President Biden raised the Office of Science and Technology Policy to cabinet level and nominated Eric Lander of MIT and Harvard to that post, a world-renowned geneticist, that made it seven members of the cabinet of about 24 people. Two more than the previous high under President Bill Clinton long ago. By contrast, the Trump cabinet never had more than two Jewish cabinet members at the same time, although, of course, he had senior advisors, not technically in the cabinet, but clearly in the president's ear, in his daughter and son-in-law, among other high Jewish officials. In any case, there will be a lot of Jewish cabinet members in the new Biden cabinet, along with a record number of women, half the cabinet, and record numbers of African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Americans. It's a diverse and talented group, and we are proud that so many Jews are included in those high-level positions. But this morning I'd like to focus instead on a few words that were spoken in the inauguration ceremonies by the youngest speaker of all, a 22-year-old poet from my hometown, Los Angeles, named Amanda Gorman, recent graduate of Harvard. She said, among other fine things, "And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left. When day comes, we step out of the shade of flame and unafraid. The new dawn balloons as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it. If only we are brave enough to be it." Great words, and it was quite a presentation, too, and rather stole the show at the inauguration from a variety of appropriate speeches, music, and pomp. It's not often when a 22-year-old outperforms everybody on such a ceremonial day, but you have to like what Amanda Gorman did last week. May this be a period of sanity, healing, and growth for our nation. To play us in this morning, here's Israeli singer Ishai Ribo singing Natan Goshen's words, "Nechakelach, we await you, God."
Amayev chovesh ptav
יושב סופר ימיו צעקות בושה בכל העיר דור רוצה תשובה עכשיו זכאי ולא חייב בגוף עייף מכישלונות בלב שבור לחתיכות נחכה לך שתקבל פנינו לך קראנו בלילות ועוד נצעק ברחובות רחם עלינו אבא אושיינו אושיינו זמן עובר כולם ממהרים דור מחיש את פעמיו רוצה הכל עכשיו שמש בשמיים אפורים עם בארץ אבותיו נלחם עוד על חייו בגוף עייף מכישלונות בלב שבור לחתיכות מחכה לך שתקבל פנינו לך קראנו בלילות ועוד נצעק ברחובות רחם עלינו אבא הושיענו הושיענו כישלונות בלב שבור לחתיכות נחכה לך שתקבל פנינו לך קראנו בלילות ועוד נצעק ברחובות רחם עלינו אבא הושיענו הושיענו
That was Natan Goshen's poem, We Will Wait For You, An Embarrassed Nation Waits to Be Healed. When we return on To Jewish in a moment, our guest, Pyotr Savinsky, the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, will be here on the occasion of the 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Its commemoration is being held today virtually. Find out how they are coping with the pandemic at this central site of the Holocaust when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsaros, a small group can join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both by emailing me, to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience weekly, as well as our in-person, masked, and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, although many of them are also in blended format. You can access those through our website or email us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Many of those classes, as well as our wonderful religious school, are available in blended formats, some live, some people, on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, also taught on Zoom and live, and of course all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Piotr Sivinsky is the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, a professional historian with an outstanding academic record. He is now in the process of preparing for the 76th commemoration of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau camps. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi. So this is such a, I'm going to start with a strange question. This is such a peculiar time for all of us, this time of coronavirus and shutdown. How has that affected the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum, and how have you adapted?
Oh, of course, it affected terrifically the entire museum. You know, the borders are quite closed. There's no venues, there's no visitors. The schools are closed, so even the group of teenagers are not coming. So last year was, I think, the worst years in the history of this memorial, even from the financial point of view, of course.
There's no fees from people coming through the museum. There's no, you know, I mean, the whole experience is different. I assume the donations are down as well.
We are able to save the team. That was very, very important because the former camp is located close to small villages and towns and not in a big universitary city, for example. But all the investments, all the projects were completely down.
In preparing for the 76th commemoration, I had the privilege of attending the 70th anniversary back in 2015. It was a remarkable experience. How have you adapted? I assume it's going to be an online experience.
Of course, it will be only an online event. However, we will work at the same way that if it were a normal anniversary, so we will have some testimonies of survivors. We will have some, let's say, more political speeches, and we will have some prayers, some candles to be put by myself alone on the monument. So the 27th January will be a little bit special, but we will preserve, let's say, the formula of the last years.
We will talk much more with Piotr Sivinsky, the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, both about the 76th commemoration and the mission of the museum, when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, and over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. today at noon, please join us on Zoom for a special awards ceremony for the Kohan Memorial Foundation. The awards ceremony is on the website, kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D.com. You can also email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for the link. It should be a great ceremony with three extraordinary winners. That's today at noon. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been discussing normalization of relations. Last week we covered embassies and where embassies go. Let's talk about other kinds of diplomatic representation and how all of that plays out.
Okay, so an embassy is the whole kit and caboodle. It's got typically a U.S. embassy in a major capital like Paris, Moscow, London, whatever, has representatives from almost every part of the U.S. government, Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, Department of Defense, et cetera, et cetera. It's a big, cumbersome bureaucracy in and of itself.
Not to mention the CIA, but never mind that.
But it also provides the full range of services that you could get if you walked the streets of Washington, D.C. for both American citizens living abroad and citizens of other countries who want to do business with the U.S. or want to visit the U.S. or have questions about the U.S., embassies are there to help. Now, typically in cities that are not capitals, but might be, in fact, bigger cities. Like New York is a much bigger city than Washington, D.C. So for that matter, Chicago. Typically, countries which have a good, rich, multidimensional bilateral relationship will have consulates in the country of their partner. So that when I served in Paris many years ago, there were U.S. consulates in Lyon, Strasbourg, Nice, Marseille, and Bordeaux. I don't know how many of those consulates are still open, because over the years, as Congress foolishly slashes the budget of the State Department year after year after year, we've had to close a number of consulates because they're expensive to keep open. But generally, the presence of lots of consulates is a sign that relationships between the two countries involved are healthy, and also sometimes just a sign that the other country is geographically large. For example, the Russian Federation, where we recently, very recently, decided to close our last two remaining consulates, one of which was 11 time zones east of Moscow. It's a huge country, and we really ought to have a presence in the Russian Far East, but we apparently no longer will. So beneath the level of embassies and consulates are all kinds, any variety, you can be as creative as you want, of liaison offices, bureaus, American Citizen Services, and also a special arrangement called interest sections. So when we had no diplomatic relations with Cuba or no diplomatic relations with Iran, there were other countries that represented our interests. And in the case of, I think, both those countries, certainly Iran, it was Switzerland. And a Swiss diplomat would do what he was or she was asked to do by Washington via Bern. And that's also a kind of representation, to have an interest section, even if you don't have any of your nationals present. Now, apart from opening embassies, consulates, whatever, whatever, what else does normalization of relations entail? Well, all kinds of regular services that exist between two normal countries that have a healthy bilateral relationship. The example I mentioned before of mail service, airline service, transfer of funds, electronic funds transfer. The ability to do anything that involves another country depends on legal frameworks established by things like an agreement to normalize relations. And then you can spell that out and you can add to it later. It's usually a de minimis thing of, we will do at least this, and perhaps in the future we'll also do this, this, and this.
Well, it's an elaborate process, obviously, and yet it seems to be moving quite quickly in places, probably because there was a lot of underlying relationship that existed before. Tom, thanks very much for explaining a very complicated subject to all of us.
I hope I made it clear.
We will talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie, new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. By the way, this week we remember the late, great Jewish comedian George Burns, who would have been 125 years old on the day of the presidential inauguration, January 20th. His best quotation was, to me, "Happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city." In a darkened room, peering into a crystal ball, the great fortune teller delivered grave news. "There's no easy way to tell you this, madam, so I'll just be blunt. Prepare yourself to be a widow. Your husband will die a violent and horrible death soon." Visibly shaken, Shirley stared at the woman's lined face, then at the single flickering candle, then down at her own hands. She took a few deep breaths to compose herself, to stop her mind from racing. But she simply had to know. She met the fortune teller's gaze, steadied her voice, and asked, "Will I be acquitted?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and be acquitted, or at least maybe pardoned. And now a word of Torah. The Torah portion of B'Shalach is justly famous for a couple of reasons. First, it tells the great tale of the crossing of the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds, or perhaps the Red Sea, and the redemption of the people of Israel from destruction at the hands of Pharaoh's army. Second, after the crossing, Moses and the people of Israel sing the magnificent Az Yashir Moshe, the Song of Moses, about their salvation through divine action. B'Shalach is always Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, celebrated with special musical services in virtually every Reform, Progressive, and Conservative synagogue in the world. The story itself couldn't be much more familiar, not only from the Torah itself and every Passover Seder you've ever gone to, but from the arts. The Exodus is featured in paintings, novels, and poems. There have even been a variety of mediocre films, ranging from the Ten Commandments to the Prince of Egypt to Exodus, Gods and Kings. Still, the story is worth hearing again. In last week's portion of Bo, the Hebrew slaves were freed following the 10th and final plague, the traumatic deaths of the firstborn throughout Egypt at the hands of the Angel of Death. Traveling light, the freshly liberated Israelites head east towards the Promised Land. This week, at the start of B'Shalach, Pharaoh changes his mind, sending his chariot army to destroy the newly minted Semitic freedmen and freedwomen, now stranded on the shore of a sea. God intervenes, wind parts the waters, the Israelites pass safely to the other side, and when Pharaoh's army pursues them, the waters return, swamping and then drowning the Egyptians. The people of Israel are redeemed, and they sing with great joy of their salvation. It's noticeable that this Shabbat Shirah, and especially the poetic call-and-response text of the Az Yashir itself, presents the most militant vision of God we've ever had in Jewish tradition. From the first line, "Horse and rider he has hurled into the sea," to "God is a man of war," through "Your right hand God shatters the enemy, and in your triumph you break your opponents, you send forth your fury, devour them like straw." God is depicted as the mightiest, most violent of all warriors. B'Shalach presents God as action hero, not peacemaker. This is not Oseh Shalom, the maker of peace. This is God acting forcefully to annihilate the enemies of his people. Adonai Ish Milchama. God is a man of war. For those who prefer beautiful images of a peace-loving Almighty God, B'Shalach presents a challenge. While we appreciate God acting directly on our behalf, and we certainly value God's role as the greatest of liberators, it is surprising to see the level of bloodthirsty violence in our parsha. Judaism has never been a pacifistic faith, but it has almost never cultivated a warrior culture. With the exception of the Maccabees, who took as their motto the most famous text from this very Song of Moses, "Mi Chamocha by Elim Adonai," Jews have never gloried in armed might or created a hero-oriented military machine. Even today's IDF remembers Golda Meir's comment that we can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. We cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children. Yet in this celebrated Torah portion, we find God glowingly portrayed as a bloodthirsty, vengeful deity, no less harsh or brutal than the Hindu Shiva or the Roman Mars, a god more suitable to Sparta than Jerusalem, the Ir Shalom, the city of peace. What are we to make of a god who celebrates life, yet here willingly administers violent death wholesale? There's an interesting linguistic piece to this puzzle. The name of God usually associated with judgment or punishment in Jewish tradition is Elohim. But powerfully and strangely, the holiest name of God, the four-letter tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is used 10 separate times in the Song of Moses, perhaps echoing the 10 plagues this same God wrought against the Egyptians. A couple of weeks ago in Shemot, God revealed God's own essence to Moses in the burning bush, telling Moses that he was now to be known uniquely by this special four-letter name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. There it was an indication of intimacy. Now, 3 weeks and just 12 chapters later, the name is repeated again and again in the context of martial power and violent action. This name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is usually understood to be a combination of the three forms of the verb to be in Hebrew: was, is, will be, past, present, and future. It implies that God represents unlimited potential beyond time and space, beyond space-time, and has unlimited power. The name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is associated with great strength and unassailable sanctity. This holiest name of God eventually was limited to a very specific use, spoken aloud only on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, by the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, as he asked for atonement for the people in the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Kodashim. Perhaps the hidden lesson here is that God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the all-powerful, all-potential, is supposed to be the only dispenser of divine justice, violent or otherwise. We mere humans are essentially a passive audience, watching this divine retribution enacted. Just as B'Shalach tells us, God is the only one who truly heals, Ani Adonai Rofecha, so the Aziah Shir is telling us that God is the only true warrior empowered to wreak vengeance. Justice is needed, but it is God, and only God, who has the capacity to enforce it when necessary. Even the fact that all this is conveyed in a vocal song, sung aloud, that is, hints at this. I remember studying classical voice for 9 years on the way to my earlier career as a chazan, a cantor. I promise you that for all the volume involved in cantorial singing, and it is loud, it is not a violent act. The best classical singers use the least tension and stress to produce the clearest, most beautiful tones. So too here, B'Shalach is subtly teaching us that in this occupation of violent killing, our role will be to sing about God, not to imitate God. I will sing a song to God because God is the man of war, and therefore I, as a Jew, do not need to become one. That was true for our ancestors on the shore of the sea. In this violent, turbulent world, we can hope and pray and even sing that it will prove to be true for all of us someday. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Piotr Savinsky, the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum of Poland, will discuss how his job has changed during COVID-19, what impact the changing political climate in Poland has had on this central monument to the Holocaust, and just what today's 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz means. Find out all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jewish millennial John Ossoff became Senator Ossoff of Georgia last week at a socially distanced swearing-in ceremony in the Senate chambers. just hours after Joe Biden was inaugurated as president. As he swore the oath of office, Ossoff held his son Sino Chumash, a version of the Torah with commentary in a book once owned by Rabbi Jacob Rothschild, the Atlanta rabbi whose synagogue building was bombed by white supremacists in 1958. Ossoff, first Jewish senator from Georgia, was sworn in alongside Reverend Raphael Warnock, the first African-American senator from the state, and Alex Padilla, who is filling in the seat vacated by the new vice president, Kamala Harris. Padilla is the first Hispanic senator from California. Ossoff, 33, was escorted down the rotunda aisle by Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, who is not Jewish but often quotes Hebrew and cites Torah passages in his public appearances. In October 1958, the Hebrew Benevolent Congregation, the Temple in Atlanta, as it's known, sustained massive damage from dynamite explosions planted by the KKK, although no one was injured. The congregation's rabbi, Jacob Rothschild, was a prominent and outspoken civil rights movement supporter and advocate for integration. That incident is chronicled powerfully in the book The Temple Bombing by Melissa Faye Green, a past guest of Two Jewish. Rabbi Jacob Rothschild was father of a good friend of mine, Rabbi Bill Rothschild, now a successful attorney in Atlanta. Ossoff, who also carried his grandparents' immigration papers from Ellis Island in his pocket when he was sworn in, and Warnock, pastored Ebenezer Baptist Church, the church formerly led by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., leaned in on the narrative of black Jewish cooperation during their campaigns. After he and Ossoff were declared winners of their runoff elections, Warnock said that Dr. King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who marched with King in the Civil Rights era, were smiling in this moment. The Ossoff and Warnock victories gave Democrats a 50-50 split in the Senate, making New York's Chuck Schumer the very first Jewish Senate majority leader in U.S. history. In less upbeat Jewish news, in Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Tucson, Jewish funeral homes are going to great lengths to try to keep up with all the deaths from COVID-19. While Jewish tradition mandates burial in as short a period of time as possible, some families are forced to wait a week or even longer for burials. One of LA's largest Jewish funeral homes, Mount Sinai Memorial Parks and Mortuaries, rented a second 12-meter refrigerator truck last week to hold the bodies. The one they rented back in March is already filled to capacity with 40 bodies. In some cases, funerals are delayed because overwhelmed doctors are too busy caring for patients at inundated hospitals and don't have time to fill out death certificates or burial permits. Howard Kaplan, the general manager at Mount Sinai, said other area cemeteries have asked his mortuary to store bodies for them because they are so backed up. His staff is now working 24 hours a day. In some cemeteries, the wait is a week or 10 days. In the bigger, non-Jewish cemeteries, they are 3 or 4 weeks out. People who have worked here for 20 years have never seen anything like this. Also, due to COVID-19, many Tahara rituals, in which a Jew's body is ritually washed before interment, have been suspended unless a family specifically requests it because of the risks associated with handling bodies infected with the virus. Instead, body bags containing the dead are being placed directly into caskets. The unprecedented COVID-19 surge in California reached a new high last week. It became the first U.S. state to report more than 3 million coronavirus cases since the outbreak of the pandemic. 1 million of those cases have been in L.A. County, home to America's second largest Jewish community with about 600,000 Jews. More than 14,000 people have died in Los Angeles, and hospital intensive care units are filled to capacity. California has the second worst average daily infection rate among states at about 100 per 100,000 people. Only Arizona is higher with 117 per 100,000 people. The proportion of coronavirus-related deaths in LA cemeteries are handling has soared along with the caseload. In November, 6% of the deaths were COVID-related. Now it's up to 35 to 40%. Arizona Jews are feeling the funeral crisis, too. At Green Acres Mortuary and Cemetery in Scottsdale, the number of COVID-19 deaths has jumped 65% in the past month, said the general manager. I have never seen anything like this personally, and I've been in the business for 24 years, said Amy Gazda, whose cemetery has a Jewish section. It's been quite overwhelming. There have been delays in burials. Hospitals get backlogged and delay releasing bodies to our care. There are delays getting death certificates and burial permits. At Mount Sinai Cemetery in Phoenix, Jewish cemetery, as here in Tucson, funeral services are no longer permitted inside because of COVID. Cemetery actually built a 32-foot outdoor pavilion for services with chairs set up 6 feet apart for the immediate family. Funerals are broadcast online. Here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, the local mortuary and cemetery, Evergreen, whose general manager, Mark Dunn, is Jewish, said that funerals are more than double the regular number. All are conducted outdoors, wearing masks and practicing social distancing. The challenge for us rabbis and cantors performing funerals, memorials, and Shiva services on Zoom is that, of course, they are not the same as being able to console mourners face-to-face, to hug them, be fully present during these times of bereavement and loss. The increase in deaths is straining all normal Jewish memorial responses. May the vaccines be fully available soon for everyone. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Piotr Savinsky is the director of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. He is a professional historian with an outstanding record in interreligious dialogue. Grew up actually in Switzerland and France to a great degree due to the political exile of his father under earlier regimes in Poland. I want to tell us a little bit about how you envision the mission of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum.
Of course, the first goal is remembrance of the victims. This is quite more and more difficult because the number of survivors is completely falling down the last years. We lose many, many friends among them. Because of the new generations also that are far and far more far from the war and from the Holocaust, and because of the difficulties that we have in all our world, the democratic world. Our democracies are suffering of populism, of demagogia sometimes, and it's not easy. Of course, it's not easy, but we need terrifically, I think, especially on those times, this remembrance, because we are also observing a rising of new form of antisemitism, racism, different type of xenophobia, and our societies in the entire world are not free of some new form of hatred.
So I want to talk a little bit about that rise of antisemitism and racism that you mentioned. In Poland, it's taken some political forms. There are marches. We read about stuff. Tell us about that issue now in Poland.
I did not have personally any problem with the government in Poland. However, of course, in the whole Europe, and not only in Poland, you can feel, let's say, some raising of new extreme way of thinking. It started in many, many different countries. And what is problematic for me is that the politicians are using more and more history in their debates, in their arguments, in the way of speaking to people. If you observe many, many different languages, many different countries, politicians are not speaking about biology, astronomy, or chemistry, but about history quite many times. And this is something problematic for me, because it's many times a very simplest that's a form of referring to the past. And the past, it's something very complex, and there is a place for historians, for researchers, for educators, not necessarily to leave that in the hand of politics.
Auschwitz-Birkenau is the most visited concentration camp complex in a normal year, of course, and we'll talk about that a little bit. People come from all over the world. college students, high school students, trips from all around the Jewish world, but not just the Jewish world. Is there a difference in the way that the museum approaches Jewish groups and non-Jewish groups that are coming to visit Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum during normal times?
Before the pandemic, we've got more than 2 million of visitors every year. And of course, if a group is not organized by a school or a university or I don't know what, or a community, we don't really know who is taking part in this group. So if somebody is not coming, let's say, and inform us that he's Jewish, or if he's not, I don't know, an Orthodox Jew, we don't know. We don't even know who is, what is his background. So not only from the historical point of view, but also from the, let's say, methodological point of view,
sure.
It would be very difficult to have different languages. But of course, there are some differences in the approach, considering from where people are coming. If you have tourists from the Far Asia with a small knowledge about Europe, we have sometimes to speak about things that are completely understood in Europe. So those differences are, let's say, more important than, in our experience than the background that we don't even know many times from the visitors.
So there's no way to make that distinction, and maybe that's not important. In the course of leading the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum, which you've led for a number of years, what changes have you seen in the course of your leadership? Obviously, many of the survivors have passed from the scene. But what other changes have you noticed?
You know, there are many, many different changes in the world of visitors. For example, in the 90s, when some classes or schools were coming with their teachers, except schools from Poland, of course, but I mean from different Western countries or different other parts of the world, the teachers were coming for the first time themselves with the class. So they were not really able to prepare the class before the visit. Now, the teachers of 2020 that were coming, they were already many times visiting this site when they were younger, when they were teenagers.
So they've been there before already.
Yeah, many times. And it changed really a lot if you want to bring your class full of teenagers to a place that you know that has some very crucial influence on your way of thinking or, I don't know, your way of understanding of the world.
You, as a Catholic leading this museum, what special perceptions does it give you into this, you know, unbelievable place, which is, of course, true?
I don't know if my religious, identity has an enormous impact on the way to work with that site. Let's say I were prepared before starting this position by many excellent survivors, not only Jewish, but among them were some Poles or some other survivors from different countries. And their, let's say, approach, their way of thinking, their way of how to remember, how to present, how to speak about this site, how to view the place of this site in the today's world, that was for me absolutely essential. Yes, I think that people like Elie Wiesel, like Israel Gutman, like many others, had a major influence on my way of thinking what should be the remembrance of Auschwitz in the today world.
I had an interesting kind of revelation when I was in Poland, which was how many young Poles in particular feel like there's something missing from the country because of the loss of the large Jewish population, of course, and the annihilation of the Shoah. It's fascinating to see. I assume you've experienced this. To what do you attribute that?
Yes, Satan, you're right. There are many people who feel that more and more, I think. It was something that was, let's say, starting in the 80s or in the 90s, you know, very, very clearly at a social level. I'm not speaking about individuals who were even before. But if 10% of the Polish populations before the war suddenly, let's say, was killed in the Shoah, buildings were still here, synagogues were still here, so cemeteries were still here, but there was nobody, or nearly nobody, some small communities in the biggest cities only. Yes, it was something that was planned. It was a part of not only a physical, let's say, Poland that disappeared, but also for many people it was a part of a cultural or even a part of a religious Poland that disappeared completely, especially in some small cities in the east, for example, some small towns. It was an important and a big change of the populations. There were cities that was at 50, 60, or even 80% Jewish before the war.
After, so changing subjects a little bit, when this coronavirus pandemic, this COVID-19 SARS, as we call it, when it becomes less restrictive, when the vaccine is circulated and God willing we come out of this, what changes do you see for the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum going forward because of this, or really just in general?
You know, our budget is now very, very difficult, extremely difficult, so we'll not be able, just after the virus, to start some very, very deep changes. However, for me, the question is not only a question of programs or a question of, I don't know, way of working. It's more the question of the understanding of Auschwitz in the today world. But many people are coming here, I mean, before the pandemic, were coming here and were really, let's say, we're feeling some deep sorrow about the past, but they were looking on the past only in the category of the history. And the past is not only something that we have to, let's say, see behind us, but it's a crucial key for the future, for the understanding of our moral anxiety that we must have in the today's world also. But I think that the real work on the remembrance is how to show to the entire world, how to explain, how to make everybody remember their own duties, their own obligations, their own responsibility today and for tomorrow. And in this situation, we'll be certainly in a wiser position confronting the today's problem that we have. The past is, you cannot change the past. The past is,
of course.
Yes, it was like it was. You cannot give back the life to the victims. But this is really a key for understanding of our way to thinking and to acting for the future. Sometimes I have the impression that due to the COVID, more and more, bystanders of our times. And this is something very, very unnormal and dangerous.
The idea that we are all responsible, that we all have a responsibility to preserve decency in our society and to fight racism, that's kind of intrinsic to the mission of Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum. I remember a survivor saying, you know, it's upon all of us. It's not a small minority that has to do this. The whole society has that responsibility. How do you best communicate that message in the experience of the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum?
You know, we have every one of us has different responsibility in his own world. Every one of us has some different, let's say, imagination of his own capacity to react. But if you look to the history once again, if you look to the time of the Shoah, If you look to the writers among the nations, they did not, created some protest songs or some official letters to politicians. No, they were just helping 1, 2, 3, 4 people, and that changed the world. So today, my problem is that we do not do nearly anything. I don't know, 3 years ago with the Rohingya massacres in Myanmar, we didn't react to the Uyghurs problem. We don't react to some anti-Semitic, groups.
A guy wearing a Camp Auschwitz T-shirt in the Capitol building after the recent attack there.
Yeah. Everybody saw that. This is something terrific, really terrific.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he didn't know what that means.
No, of course he knew what it meant.
Yeah, of course. Now in Yemen, people are suffering of malnutrition. Now, there's really many problems. And during the COVID, we are more and more closed on our approach perspective, losing a little bit this sense of tikkun olam, let's say. Tikkun olam, it's not something that must be reserved to my very close own world.
I want to thank Piotr Savinsky for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum and maybe to offer some financial help in this challenging time?
Thank you very much for this discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The website, you simply Google Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum and you'll be able to bring some assistance. Thank you again. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Don't forget to sign in at noon for the Kohan Memorial Foundation 2020 Awards. Should be great fun. It's on Zoom. You can go to KohanAward.com to find out the exact Zoom address or email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our playout this morning comes from Amir Dadon and Shuli Rand, the song Ben Kodesh Lechol. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Ben Kodesh Lechol, ani chai. עם האמת שמשתוללת בי, עם אלף הרגלים, עם כל צלקת שעל פניי. אני יוצא שוב לפזר את המילים, בין המציאות לשיגעון, הכל חוזר אליי, שם במקום ממנו באתי אין שלום. והמסע הזה כבד וקצת גדול עליי, אני צריך לגדול מזה ודי, לגדול מזה ודי. בין קודש לחול אני חי, בין האמת שמשתוללת בי, עם אלף הרגלים, עם כל הפחד שעל כתפיי. אני יוצא שוב לפזר את המילים, בין המציאות לשיגעון, הכל חוזר אליי, שם במקום ממנו באתי אין שלום. והמסע הזה כבד וקצת גדול עליי, אני צריך לגדול מזה ודי, לגדול מזה ודי. שמור
המציאות לשגעון, הכל חוסר אליי, גם במקום ממנו באתי אין שלום.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.